Welcome to Cases from the Community, a special audio program focused on the management of pancreatic cancer that was developed from a satellite CME meeting held at the 2019 Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, we put together a working group of five community-based medical oncologists and asked them to submit challenging cases and questions from their practices, and this served as the framework for the discussion with the faculty at the live meeting in San Francisco. The community oncologists included Drs. Warren Brenner, Yajun Ma, Sulfi Ibrahim, Atif Hussein, and Namrata Peswani. Our faculty for the meeting was Drs. Andrew Hendafar, Eileen O'Reilly, Philip Phillip, and Margaret Tempero. The first module focused on available and emerging research guiding the treatment of resectable or borderline resectable pancreatic cancer. And to begin, we presented a case from our working group of a 66-year-old man with borderline resectable primary pancreatic adenocarcinoma, which had encased 120 degrees of the superior mesenteric vein. Neoadjuvant treatment with FOLFIRINOX resulted in tumor shrinkage, and the patient was able to undergo an R0 resection. The question from the working group was, what was the likelihood of the patient's disease being rendered resectable after neoadjuvant therapy?
First of all, I think we need to talk about what we mean by borderline resectable. So I have the privilege of chairing the NCCN guidelines panel. And 20 years ago, when that started, I had a multidisciplinary team from all the institutions in the NCCN, and I realized right away that the surgeons couldn't agree on what was resectable. And I finally understood that what they were really worried about was an R1 resection. So that's a margin positive resection. That's one thing they really wanted to avoid, because that was like having no surgery at all. And so we came up with the definition of borderline resectable as a result of those discussions. So borderline resectable is resectable. Every borderline resectable patient should go to surgery. Now, true, we believe that you may be able to optimize or minimize the chance of an R1 resection with preoperative therapy, but all of these patients are resectable to begin with.
That's a really interesting perspective. Philip, another question that Dr. Hussein has is the optimal neoadjuvant therapy. This patient got FOLFIRINOX, and a lot of patients certainly do get FOLFIRINOX. Is that usually your approach, Philip? And what about other alternatives such as GEM-NAB?
The neoadjuvant treatment, at this point in time, we're relying on some early studies that were done, pilot trials, and the evidence is probably best we have it for the use of FOLFIRINOX. So I would agree with the use of FOLFIRINOX in a patient like this. And in fact, that would be my own practice at this point in time. In fact, the most recent randomized trial at the national level was using FOLFIRINOX as the induction treatment. The role of the radiation treatment goes back to something which we have to know about borderline resectable. As Dr. Tempero said, these are resectable patients. But with borderline resectable, the surgeon has a higher chance of leaving an R1 resection or leaving something behind microscopic. And for that reason, for a long time, people strongly felt that radiation treatment is a component of the treatment to be given neoadjuvantly. Usually, a few months of chemotherapy, let's say with FOLFIRINOX, and then giving the chemoradiotherapy for surgery. However, recently, that concept may have been challenged by some findings in the national trial, which was led by the Alliance. So at this point in time, although we may feel that based on the recent findings in the trial that radiation treatment is not necessary, I still think that it's something which we cannot rule it out completely.
Eileen, one other question that Dr. Hussein had about this case is the issue of this circumferential tumor involvement. You also wanted to know about vascular resection. Any comments?
Yeah, so the vascular involvement sort of dictates where in the spectrum of resectable to locally advanced and unresectable patients are. So for borderline resectable, we're mostly talking about venous involvement. Locally advanced is typically arterial significant involvement and encasement. And as Margaret was saying, borderline resectable by definition means you can go to the operating room tomorrow, but you have a very high probability of having at least an R1 positive margin. So that's why the spectrum of thinking about moving systemic therapy preoperatively has emerged to facilitate a negative margin resection and at the same time treat micrometastatic disease.
What about vascular resection?
So vascular resections are done in terms of venous resections with, I wouldn't say it's an everyday occurrence, but by experienced pancreas surgeons, they are done with some frequency. Arterial resections are much more controversial and usually speak to a much more advanced tumor locally and unfavorable biology. But even there's been some temptation by some groups to venture there, but I think the success is very much challenged.
What about this issue, Andrew, of choice of neoadjuvant therapy? We put these scenarios out. We know that if you really see a patient, you're going to take individual issues in mind, the patient's attitude, some comorbidities, et cetera. We're kind of just asking in general. Andrew, how do you think through the choice of neoadjuvant therapy in this situation?
Yeah, it's a great question. Our thinking in the clinic, it's kind of 50-50. It's usually very patient-dependent. I think since FOLFIRINOX has been shown to be highly effective in the adjuvant or post-operative setting, it now creates unique issues where even if we do give nab-paclitaxel gemcitabine prior to surgery and we have a good response, then we ask the same questions after surgery. So I think as of now, I think either regimen is appropriate, and then you kind of have to come to a difficult choice in patients who respond to nab-paclitaxel gemcitabine, because after surgery, really, you should be getting FOLFIRINOX if clinically appropriate.
The next case from our working group was an 89-year-old man with pancreatic cancer that was technically resectable. The patient declined surgery and was treated with a modified dose of gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, followed by stereotactic body radiation therapy, and is faring well 1 year later. Dr. Brenner posed the question of the optimal approach to the treatment of very elderly patients for whom surgery is not feasible.
Well, I pull out an old trick out of my hat called gemcitabine and capecitabine. It's a regimen that's not very well tolerated in the United States, was tested in the UK in metastatic disease and showed improved progression-free survival, but didn't quite meet it for overall survival. We adapted that regimen with fixed-dose rate gemcitabine and have published that. It's very active, and it's very good for this elderly patient population. So it's a good choice, I think, when you don't want to use gemcitabine monotherapy, but you're a little bit worried about the toxicity of, say, gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel.
Philip, this patient actually got SBRT after the chemo. What about SBRT or radiation therapy in these elderly patients who are resectable but not fit for surgery, Philip?
So this is a patient who did not get surgery because of the age. This is something which I would do in my practice because in those patients, you still have the issue about local progression and the symptomatic consequences of that, such as pain, biliary obstruction, and other complications. So that would be my option. Now, whether we use SBRT or the regular IMRT, that's still controversial. I don't think there's a good answer there. But in my opinion, an SBRT would be a reasonable approach in this patient.
Margaret, you had a comment?
Yeah, I wouldn't actually. I would treat with chemotherapy, give them a significant course of chemotherapy, watch the CA19-9, make sure that the patient is getting better, and then give a finite course of therapy and stop. There has been a randomized trial of gemcitabine followed by radiation or not in locally advanced disease, and that didn't seem to provide any benefit. Now, one could argue that maybe with more effective chemotherapy, there's going to be a difference with radiation, but to date, it hasn't been shown.
Eileen?
So no survival benefit, but I think there is a local control benefit to chemoradiation, and in terms of mitigation of pain and buying additional time off of systemic therapy, that's sometimes a consolidation strategy that is, I think, at least worthy of discussion with patients. And I think another point to bring up here, which was utilized in this case, that SBRT is actually well tolerated in an older population, and the Hopkins group have some added to the literature in a meaningful way to support that modality in this population.
Dr. Hussein also asked about the issue of the CA19-9 earlier, and I'm just kind of curious, we asked the audience, Andrew, what about neoadjuvant therapy? This patient was resectable, of course, you know, 89 years old. But what about neoadjuvant therapy in the younger patient who is resectable? This is a strategy that has created a lot of interest. It actually looks like the audience leans towards doing that in a patient with 70 years old.
I think the audience might be doing a better job than we are. So when it comes to resectable patients, because we have a programmatic approach and we have a multidisciplinary team, we have to be fair to each other and set up practice guidelines within our group. Right now, resectable patients go to surgery first. But at the same time, neoadjuvant chemotherapy for this patient population is entirely acceptable and actually being studied in multiple ongoing studies.
So, of course, we want to ask where people stand in terms of adjuvant therapy, and I'm asking Margaret to respond because, as always, she gave a different response. But I want to hear how she approaches a 75-year-old patient who's gotten through surgery, and now you have the issue of adjuvant therapy. And Margaret, the audience looks like they're split between gemcitabine, which was the standard last year, versus FOLFIRINOX, with another significant fraction using gem-nab and a lesser extent gemcitabine. How do you think through the choice of adjuvant therapy, Margaret?
Well, I think the first issue is the fitness of the patient. Many patients following surgery aren't doing so well, and they might not be able to withstand the challenges, say, of modified FOLFIRINOX. So a lot of it has to do with fitness or ongoing morbidity. So I think you have to really assess that and choose a regimen that you think your patient's going to tolerate. So there's three choices here, basically. There's FOLFIRINOX, there's gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, and there's gemcitabine and capecitabine. And I use sort of a toxicity scale of 1 to 10, you know, where I put FOLFIRINOX up at about a 7 or an 8, and gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel at maybe a 5 or a 6, and gemcitabine and capecitabine is a 2 or a 3. And so you can just kind of pick from that in terms of the fitness of the patient.
Interesting. You mentioned the use of gem-nab in the adjuvant setting. And actually, it looks like, Eileen, not very many people in the audience have done that outside a clinical trial setting. Have you?
So a couple of times, and in fact, it was both instances that I can recall were two individuals that had enrolled on the randomized study of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel compared to gemcitabine, and that's the APACT trial that we're waiting data from. And they got randomized to the control arm and were resourced individuals and elected their way to receive the combination outside of a study.
Interesting. Andrew, what about just using gem-nab outside a clinical trial? We really, certainly in the adjuvant setting, we don't really have the data. Have you done it?
I've done it before the recent data with modified FOLFIRINOX, and now with the data out with FOLFIRINOX, if I'm giving multi-agent chemotherapy, I tend to use that regimen instead.
Quick question from the audience specifically for you, Margaret. Quote, do you still recommend gemcitabine to be given at 10 milligrams per meter squared per minute?
Well, it depends.
She always depends.
I often do that when I need to. Let's say I have a patient who's on gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel 3 weeks out of four, and they're not tolerating it. They're having myelosuppression, just not doing very well. So I give it every other week, but I give it with fixed dose rate gemcitabine. There is an incremental, small, tiny benefit with fixed dose rate gemcitabine. That was shown in an old ECOG study. It just wasn't a game changer. But there is a little bit of benefit. So when you're tweaking things to try and improve the patient's situation, I think it's a reasonable thing to do.
So Philip, what about adjuvant therapy in a patient who had neoadjuvant therapy and then surgery? Do you use it? How do you determine whether to use it? Which regimen?
So again, this is a common tumor board issue. I mean, this is where we sit as experts and see a couple of my fellows here. So if someone receives neoadjuvant treatment, and they have a very good response to the treatment in terms of the outcome of the pathological assessment. For example, lymph nodes disappeared and the tumor is like 1 centimeter left. This is a patient who I am encouraged to give more treatment because they responded well. So the patient proved to you biologically that they're a good responder. And then you have the other end of the spectrum. You have someone you gave the treatment and they ended up with 5 lymph nodes in the pathological specimen. And this is a patient who clearly did not respond to the treatment. So there's really no point in giving the same treatment. The question here is if you reverse your treatment regimen to a gem nab-paclitaxel or a gem capecitabine, are you really going to get any mileage? In my opinion, it's unlikely, but some people do it as a last resort. In my opinion, those patients, I have a discussion with them. Most of the time, in my practice, I will not give them additional adjuvant treatment because they were resistant to the therapy. One more thing, in patients who end up with an R1 resection, those patients will be probably getting additional adjuvant treatment. And patients who get an R2 resection, to me, is like metastatic disease. I go for second-line treatment.
Eileen, just finishing out on this issue of neoadjuvant therapy in the resectable patient, I was quite surprised so many people in the audience are doing this. Do you do this, and what kind of situations?
Yeah, so I think this is an evolving paradigm, and there are people who have very fixed opinions in both dimensions, but I think this is still very much a discussion to be answered in terms of what's an optimal strategy for a given patient. But settings where we would consider upfront neoadjuvant therapy are an individual who has, say, an iffy lesion in the liver, you're not sure whether there's something there or not, somebody with a significantly elevated CA99, we might be more weighted for a patient who has a tail primary, etc. So there are some examples, or their vascular involvement is more than, you know, one is comfortable in terms of upfront resection. But I would equally say there are patients when we meet them and there's a clear margin around the vessels and there's no concern, it's a small tumor. I think in those people we'll absolutely go directly to surgery.
So Andrew, here's the question from the audience, or the case actually. Would you give neoadjuvant chemo to resectable pancreatic cancer where imaging shows an obvious cancer, but the FNA is non-diagnostic?
Oh.
Or would you recommend surgery? That's an easy one, just kidding.
Actually, that comes up not too infrequently. If the patient's resectable and the tissue is non-diagnostic, highly recommend surgery first.
In the next module, we talked about the selection of therapy for patients with locally advanced unresectable pancreatic cancer and for first-line metastatic disease. We presented another case from the working group of a 56-year-old man with locally advanced unresectable pancreatic cancer who was treated with FOLFIRINOX and achieved a good response but had to discontinue therapy after 3 months due to intolerance. The patient continued with chemoradiation but 1 month later presented with malignant ascites. In our symposium, I asked Dr. Philip if he'd come across this scenario and to comment on how long he continues induction therapy.
Yeah, I've done it so long that I've seen everything. Not bragging. But yes, it can happen. But I have to really give you a word of caution. Ascites alone, unless you prove it's malignant,
agree.
Don't think it's malignant.
Agree.
Always. Because it could be something vascular. So you're doing all these things, radiation, surgery, no surgery here, but you always have to rule out the fact that was this really a malignant ascites. It could be portal circulation problem.
So you've seen that, so transudate from portal vein obstruction.
Yes, so you always have to think about that, not just jump into the conclusion this is malignant, because it may be that ultimately it's not a good thing anyway, but you have to know that. So it can happen. It's not typical the way this patient has progressed. You're absolutely right. In terms of the chemoradiation, when do I do it in a situation like this? I personally like to give the maximum amount of systemic exposure. And in my book, this is really 4 to 6 months of treatment. I have stopped earlier, 4 to 6 months, but I also stopped earlier. But in this patient who's not tolerating well, the FOLFIRINOX could have been downgraded to like a doublet could have been done and continue with more treatment. That's also a possibility. In locally advanced unresectable patients, in my practice and the recent LAPAC trial that we did, it's 6 months of treatment and then you decide on what to do afterwards in terms of the chemoradiotherapy. But I think anything after 4 months, really, you can start to use the chemoradiotherapy in someone who's simply fed up or unable to tolerate the chemotherapy.
Margaret?
I was going to say, we did an interesting study once where we were looking at the kinetics of CA99, how rapidly it declined. And we discovered, much to our surprise, that patients who had very, very rapid decline in CA19-9 actually had a shorter survival than patients who had a slower decline in CA19-9. So we weren't comparing this to response or anything, but it kind of speaks to there must be something biologically different about the people who have really, really rapid and fast responses to therapy. Maybe somehow there's a more enriched stem cell component or something. You could posit all kinds of things.
The next case from our working group was a 46-year-old woman with pancreatic cancer and a single liver metastasis. The patient was treated with FOLFIRINOX and a good response followed by surgical resection, but then developed recurrent disease and was treated with gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel with good response for about a year. Dr. Ibrahim posed the question of what the role is of surgical resection in patients with oligometastatic pancreatic cancer who are having a good response to systemic treatment.
This is a very difficult scenario and a great question. And we do frequently see this in the clinic, but I would advise caution in any patient who is metastatic to proceed with a metastectomy, especially when the patient requires a Whipple surgery in addition to it, because the surgery itself has a high level of morbidity. And when someone who has a metastatic lesion, even if that's not metastatic, as we know from the data, the chance of cure is not that great, but it's even much lower in a patient with metastatic disease. We've had patients who are young, might have a tail lesion, might have a biological phenotype that's not a classic pancreas cancer, where this kind of aggressive approach might be more warranted, maybe a BRCA-altered patient, and Eileen can speak to that. But I would exercise a lot of caution before doing something like that.
So Philip and Eileen both actually were on an ASCO guideline that I think was very interesting in terms of management of metastatic disease. And I think that, and Philip has a really interesting algorithm. But Philip, I wanted to ask the audience a couple questions that are embedded in your algorithm. And Eileen, maybe you can respond to this. And then we'll see how it matches up with the ASCO guidelines for first-line therapy. So one of the things that it gets into is the patient has had prior systemic therapy. And of course, there are a lot of variables to look at, but one in particular is how long the metastatic disease develops after that. So we presented a situation where it was less than 6 months. So the patient gets neoadjuvant FOLFIRINOX, has surgical resection, Eileen, but 5 months later has metastatic disease. The audience, and I think the guidelines say GEM-NAB. Eileen, do you agree?
Yeah, that was my choice as well for this one. And you put out the key thing that we think about is the time at which the relapse happens after surgery in relationship to the timing of neoadjuvant therapy. And less than 6 months sort of speaks to primary resistance. I mean, we don't know this with absolute terms in pancreas cancer, and our choices are finite. So for this individual, the initial choice for me would be gem-nab-paclitaxel, but I would certainly leave open the option at the time of progression, pending performance status, to consider modified FOLFIRINOX or even nanoliposomal irinotecan 5-FU. So recycling some of the drugs that the patient had in the neoadjuvant setting.
So Andrew, here's another scenario that's in the guidelines, and there I think there's a couple of alternatives. So this is a situation where the patient gets adjuvant GEM capecitabine, which prior to ASCO, I think a lot of people were utilizing, but again, with an early relapse. It looks like the audience is heavily in favor of either FOLFIRINOX or modified FOLFIRINOX. Andrew, agree?
I agree. I think if you have a patient who's failed both GEM and capecitabine, you could argue that they failed both the gemcitabine-based and a 5-FU-based regimen, so you could pick a second-line therapy and you could go either way depending on how comfortable you are.
Either way in terms of what?
Either a GEM-based combination or a 5-FU-based combination.
The next case presented from our working group was an 80-year-old woman who developed metastases to the liver 1 year after being treated for localized pancreatic cancer. The patient received gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel and had excellent disease control. Subsequently, she was treated with radiofrequency ablation, followed by a chemotherapy break with stable disease thereafter. The question from the working group related to the role of local therapies, such as surgery and radiofrequency ablation, in a patient with oligometastatic or limited metastatic disease after induction chemotherapy.
Normally, I would say that, you know, there's no role for local therapy in this disease once it is metastatic, regardless of whether it's oligometastatic or not. One might say, for instance, you might have a very rare patient who recurs many, many years after resection, and maybe it's just pulmonary metastases. Well, maybe there's a role there, but we have no evidence to guide us, and I can't say that in my experience, I've ever seen a local therapy, once there is metastatic disease, really have a huge impact on a patient's overall survival, or at least my sense of their overall survival. So I don't do this very often, but like I said, if there's something unusually indolent about the patient's course, then that I might consider.
So Philip, some of the things that this consensus group discussed in terms of management is the patient for first-line metastatic disease. There's a lot of interesting language. There are actually two papers, the original one 2016 and then the more recent one, this in 2018. But the issue of the patient who presents with good performance status and the issue of age. So we presented this patient being age 75, which I think is a little bit on the borderline in what your paper talks about. How do you think through choice of first-line therapy, Philip, based on age?
So, Neil, there is no science here. There is one thing, which is talking to the patient and the family and stating what the goals of the treatment are and understanding what they prefer. So this is how I would discuss and reply to a question. So in a patient who's 75 and my goal is to stabilize the disease and give her maybe a prolonged life a bit within what I can do with the chemotherapy, but with good quality of life, it's hard to not favor gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel in a patient like this. In my practice, this will be gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel preferred.
And of course, you know, no matter what cancer we're talking about, again, this always comes up of the elderly patient. People say age is just a number, and then you say, suppose they're 95, and you know, you start really getting into some numeracy here. But one of the things, Andrew, that we ask the audience is, in terms of FOLFIRINOX, what's their bar? We asked the audience, what was the age of the oldest patient that they gave FOLFIRINOX to?
It's a brave audience.
Very few people here have given it to anybody over age 80. And actually, I can tell you the answers of the faculty, not in any particular order, were 77, 84, 79, and 88. And actually, Andrew, you were the person who said 88. So can you describe this 88-year-old man?
Age is just a number. This particular gentleman had a very high muscle mass, very strong, and the regimen was quite modified. So I think, again, age is a good kind of general guide to a patient's status and muscle content and performance and ability to handle triplet chemotherapy. But of course, some patients break the mold.
So again, one of the things, Eileen, that you all got into in that paper is choice of therapy based on performance status. And both of these papers are great papers to read. I really recommend them because you get a lot of granularity in the paper itself. But one of the issues comes up with PS2. So we presented a situation of a younger patient, but who is ambulatory but unable to work. So, you know, some of the elements of PS2. Eileen, how do you approach a patient like this? And there's a choice of therapy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to a discussion with the patient. As Philip was saying, in terms of the goals, I think their concerns as to whether they want an infusion pump or alopecia, those are important issues for a lot of patients that help decide. For, you know, a 65-year-old with a PS of 2, I mean, I think traditionally we would be thinking gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, but I would also say very modified versions of FOLFIRINOX 2 with reduced dosing are an option. And I think the whole issue of FOLFIRINOX versus modified FOLFIRINOX, in my opinion, it's gone. We have the SWOG study in metastatic disease show the best survival that we've seen with this regimen with modified FOLFIRINOX, and the story in the adjuvant setting, I think, also supports that. So I always upfront preemptively reduce the components of these drugs.
What is the toxicity that you most commonly see that's problematic with FOLFIRINOX, Eileen?
I think the biggest one is fatigue, which can be particularly debilitating, and people are, you know, laid up for a week or 10 days, and that's very hard for people. I think that, to me, is, it's not so much the GI issues, although I don't mean to minimize those, or the myelosuppression. Those we can address and adjust, but the fatigue is a challenge.
I just want to pick up a little bit, because that was actually my favorite part of these papers, was the discussion you have, the preliminary discussion, goals of therapy. Margaret, I can recall a classic paper written by George Sudge and Kathy Miller about metastatic breast cancer, where they talked all about this issue of sitting down with the patient and talking about goals of therapy. Margaret, can you share your own clinical experience and how you approach these patients?
You know, until we have a biomarker to tell us which treatment a patient is likely to be resistant to, you've got to really base your discussion on patient preference and the toxicity profile. I mean, some patients, they don't want to be bald. They would rather take more toxicity rather than lose their hair. So it's really all about what the patient wants, and having a frank discussion about that is really, really important.
One other thing, Eileen, that I saw in the paper, the group talks about the idea of support for very aggressive therapy. So I guess the issue of a patient who's by themselves at home, et cetera. What were some of the discussions that went on about that?
I think we want to make sure there's a designated healthcare proxy for some of these patients, or if it's an older person or a single person living on their own, that they have a friend or a family member that's trusted, that's involved in their care and, you know, able to back up. I do think it is a concern giving these regimens for people who don't have good support systems. I think in general we worry in terms of risks of toxicities and those, of course, considerations. So in the setting of palliation, I think we have to acknowledge the finite limitations of our therapy and make the therapy as palatable as possible. And part of that is being able to deliver it. And you can only deliver it if the patient can tolerate it. So I think that's part of the thinking that we had as the group.
So I want to throw a case from the audience to Margaret.
Here's the case. It's pretty wild. I'm just going to read what I have here. U.S. born with no international travel patient receives M-fulfirinox for stage 4 pancreatic cancer, developed active miliary TB. Quote, this caught me off guard, I imagine so. I was thinking his weight loss and low-grade fever was from the cancer, but it was from TB. Have you seen this, Margaret?
You know, I'm currently following about 3 patients with atypical TB. That's fairly common, but standard TB, no, I have not.
Anybody, you've seen it?
I've contracted TB, actually. I converted in my clinic.
Really?
Yeah. So we thought a patient from Korea had a metastatic disease to the lungs, but they had active TB. And we kept trying to understand why he kept coughing and coughing. And of course, he was found to have active pulmonary TB.
Not to be too naive, but would this be related to chemotherapy, for example?
I don't believe so. I think it was just a rare circumstance.
In the next module, we discuss the management of patients with metastatic disease who experience disease progression after first-line therapy. The case we presented from our working group was a 66-year-old woman with pancreatic cancer and liver metastases. She initially received gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, and on progression was treated with nanoliposomal irinotecan plus 5-FU leucovorin, which was tolerated well except for some neutropenia. The question from the working group was the incidence of grade 3-4 neutropenia or neutropenic fever after an O'Leary 5-FU leucovorin and whether there's any correlation between the development of neutropenia and response to treatment.
So I can start with the neutropenic fever. In fact, I rarely see it unless I'm dealing with maybe someone with a stent or something which can get easily infected with a bit of a low white cell count. The grade 3-4 neutropenia in my own practice is less than 20%, and there's a reason for that. And I don't use growth factors, but I tend to look at the patient and decide whether I have to start with a full dose or start with a lower dose. Patients who are older, I don't start with 70. Patients who have received prior radiotherapy, I don't start with 70. And patients who have had bad experience with myelosuppression in the past, I know I shouldn't be starting on 70. I haven't seen myself a relation between neutropenia and response to therapy.
So Eileen, what about the second set of questions? This question comes up all the time. O'Leary 5-FU leucovorin versus FOLFIRI. Do we have any data on that? Any thoughts about it, Eileen?
Yeah, so there's no comparative data of FOLFIRI compared to nanoliposomal irinotecan 5-FU. It's a common question that comes up. And there's some potentially interesting attractions of nanoliposomal irinotecan in terms of tumor penetration. And we have another nanoliposomal particle drug that's FDA approved with nab-paclitaxel in pancreas cancer. And theoretically, you may get more drug in the tumor and less sort of free circulating irinotecan or SN38, its active metabolite. So there's some of the theoretic advantages. But I think we just don't know. What we do have, though, is we have level one evidence for one regimen and we don't for the other. So I think that has obviously a logical impact in terms of practice guidelines. And I use both, and I can't say I'm consistent here, consistently inconsistent, I think, but I use both, and I think both are active in this disease.
So what about his question, Eileen, about whether you need to use the 5-FU leucovorin?
Yes, you do need to use it. So in the randomized study of nanoliposomal irinotecan, 5-FU and leucovorin, compared to single agent nanoliposomal irinotecan, single agent was inferior. So that we know from the phase 3 data. So there really is no data to support single agent nanoliposomal irinotecan, as I think there's really no data to support single agent irinotecan.
Andrew, what about this question, whether you see responses to O'Leary after irinotecan therapy?
I think occasional responses have been seen in patients who were treated, for example, neoadjuvant FOLFIRINOX, and then second-line patients who've received 5-FU and O'Leary. I'm not so sure, though, that you can take those anecdotal happenings and create a practice of doing that routinely.
What about this question about UGT1A prior to starting O'Leary?
That's a great question. I would say no, but if someone has Gilbert's disease or elevated indirect bilirubin, that would clue me to check this test, but generally no.
So a couple of second-line scenarios, and Philip, maybe you can respond to this one. 72-year-old patient who's not a candidate for FOLFIRINOX, gets gem-nab, and then has disease progression after 6 cycles. The audience says O'Leary 5-FU leucovorin. Philip, agree or disagree?
So my practice is exactly Naliri 5 if you look over. Why I don't use FOLFIRI, because we don't have second line data in a randomized setting. Palliative care, well, the patient is still able to take more chemotherapy. But the most important question here, Neil, is the FOLFOX. Do we use FOLFOX in the second line? The FOLFOX data has been a bit controversial. If you use OFF that the Europeans use, maybe you have better chance of proving it. But when it comes to FOLFOX itself, our own experience from studies done at SWOG as control arm for experimental treatment, but most importantly, the Canadian study, which showed FOLFOX to be inferior to 5-FU leucovorin. So at this point in time, in terms of the level of evidence, the Naliri 5-FU leucovorin has the stronger evidence.
That was part of the ASCO update.
The next case from our working group was a 74-year-old woman with metastatic pancreatic cancer who received FOLFIRINOX but had to discontinue oxaliplatin after 3 months because of neurotoxicity. 6 months later, she developed disease progression, and the working group was curious about how the faculty approaches the use of oxaliplatin while using FOLFIRINOX in a situation like this where the patient develops neuropathy.
Well, I mean, first of all, you don't want to push a patient to severe neuropathy because about 20% of patients on oxaliplatin will have permanent neuropathy, and you really want to avoid that. So I do agree with stopping oxaliplatin for significant neuropathy. Now, it's not clear in this case whether the patient was just taken off all treatment and then progressed 6 months later, but if that's what happened, I would probably just re-challenge with FOLFIRI and not reintroduce the oxaliplatin.
And here's a poll question sort of related to that. What's your second-line therapy, Andrew, in a patient who gets first-line FOLFIRINOX and then has disease progression? Again, I think this is one of the points of the update to the ASCO. The audience, most of them say GemNab. Do you agree?
I agree, GemNab, absolutely.
So we got a number of questions from the audience. What do you use third-line after FOLFIRINOX and GemNab? Quote, can you use Naliri? Andrew, what about third-line therapy? How often do you give third-line therapy in metastatic disease? And what is your third-line therapy after FOLFIRINOX and GemNab?
I rarely give third-line chemotherapy in pancreas cancer. In this scenario, I would give, if I decided the patient would benefit from it, and that would have to be the caveat that the patient received substantial benefit to the prior two lines, and they were one of the long-term survivors, then I would do Naliri and 5-FU leucovorin. But in general, I'm very reluctant to give third-line therapy, and I would recommend clinical trials generally.
So here's a case, another case from the audience, Margaret, 80-year-old man, locally advanced pancreatic cancer, excellent performance status, receives 5 cycles of neoadjuvant FOLFIRINOX, did well initially, but then developed recurrent aspiration pneumonia, found to have a paralyzed left vocal cord, systemic imaging completely unchanged. Have you seen this, Margaret? And if this is grade 1 neuropathy, can you rechallenge the patient?
So we're assuming that the paralyzed vocal cord is from oxaliplatin?
That's what the person is suggesting. What do you think?
I think recurrent aspiration pneumonia is a really bad thing, and I wouldn't continue any oxaliplatin if you really thought that was the reason.
Have you ever seen that?
I've never seen it.
Okay. Philip, here's another case. Stage 4 pancreatic cancer with liver mets on FOLFIRINOX goes into PET CR. How long do you continue chemo in excellent responders with no cumulative toxicity? Do you suggest drug holidays? Do you suggest approach? Or do you use maintenance? What about a patient who's doing very well, Philip?
So someone who gets a PET CR, that's unusual. And I'll be happy to stop the treatment and just watch him. I wouldn't continue more, unless the PET CR was after 2 cycles or 2 months, which is unlikely. So presumably the patient had at least 4 months of treatment. If my patient gets a PET CR, that's a bonus, and I don't want to punish him further. My last patient, or only patient, who had a PET CR and is alive 6 years, I convinced him to be tested for BRCA, and he turned out to be BRCA2 positive.
Wow, interesting. So another question, Eileen, do you use single agent 5-FU or capecitabine maintenance in patients after FOLFIRINOX? And what about the issue of maintenance in general in pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, so I think it's a very topical issue and a very important issue in pancreas cancer because we do see a reasonable number of patients who respond to frontline therapy and are starting to experience cumulative side effects from treatment or the response has plateaued. And personally, I am a fan of the idea of de-escalating treatment and continuing maintenance, but favor a combination approach in this strategy. So for those that have been on FOLFIRINOX, drop the oxaliplatin and continue FOLFIRI. And we had a randomized phase two that was presented from the Prodige group at ASCO, addressing this question, suggesting that this was a reasonable thing to do and spare some toxicity. In terms of capecitabine as monotherapy, I personally am unconvinced that single agent in this era of combination cytotoxics is sufficiently active in terms of disease suppression. But I'm hoping we'll have a change in that thinking with the PARP story and potentially PARP inhibitors as maintenance, but that's in a targeted setting.
Margaret, just to follow up and get your thoughts about the last two topics we brought up, drug holidays, treatment holidays in metastatic disease, and maintenance therapy in metastatic disease, Margaret.
So I'm really a big fan of treatment holidays, and the same trial that Eileen just referred to gave me reassurance that it was okay, because the only benefit was at the very tail of the curve with the maintenance 5-FU. But I agree with you that if you can minimize a neuropathy with FOLFIRINOX by a shorter course, followed by some treatment de-escalation, I think that's a terrific thing. But my patients seem to appreciate their treatment holiday, and it can be very long, actually, after a good response.
In the last module, we talked about novel agents and strategies in pancreatic cancer. And to begin, I asked Dr. Philip what routine genetic testing he assesses patients with who have pancreatic cancer, and if he agreed with most of the audience who routinely test patients for both MSI and BRCA.
I fully agree, but let me just put three caveats here. Number one, how do you do it? Do you do it separately through the pathology, or you order it through a multi-gene profiling? That's number one. Number two, the BRCA mutation, do you do it in the tumor, or you do a germline, which is like the blood, the lymphocytes? And the gold standard still is to do the blood. That's the second one, which is really very important. And the third one is, how do you do it? When do you do it? Do you do it at the time of the diagnosis? Well, that's ideal, but you have to really understand some of the limitations where you have to wait and things like that. So the timing is important. But in my practice, a tertiary referral center, I do it when I get the patient, but by the time I get the tumor, send it out and all that, it may be that I'll be ready more for the second line treatment.
So it kind of reminds me a little bit, we asked this a similar question a couple years ago in prostate cancer, castrate resistant prostate cancer, and all of a sudden I realized that GU investigators are doing BRCA testing, giving PARP inhibitors to patients with prostate cancer. So we asked the audience, would you give a PARP inhibitor to a patient with metastatic disease who had a BRCA germline mutation? And most of the people here either have already done it or would do it for the right patient. Andrew, have you used a PARP inhibitor in a patient with pancreatic cancer?
I have.
Have you seen any responses?
Yes, absolutely. It's very active in patients with the right germline alterations.
Another working group case that we discussed was a 71-year-old woman with metastatic pancreatic cancer and a BRCA1 germline mutation who experienced an excellent response to FOLFIRINOX. The patient was then enrolled in the randomized POLO trial of olaparib versus placebo maintenance after first-line platinum-based chemotherapy. Subsequent to this meeting, a press release came out stating that the POLO trial met its primary endpoint and demonstrated a significant improvement in progression-free survival with olaparib. It is not known if this patient received the placebo or olaparib, but has no evidence of disease now 32 months after the initiation of treatment. I asked Dr. Philip if this response could be due to the platinum as well.
Exactly right. And then it raises the question, which is the best platinum? Because now maybe there's a possibility of bringing back gemma cisplatin back, because some people think that cisplatin might be even a better drug than oxaliplatin, and maybe the gemcis being an easier regimen than FOLFIRINOX.
So Eileen, a couple of questions Dr. Brenner has. First of all, how do you manage, if you're going to manage a patient with a BRCA germline mutation outside a trial setting, how do you integrate PARP inhibitors and platinum? Any thoughts about that? Ovary has the platform of, you know, platinum and then PARP maintenance. Breast, they just give PARPs, you know, their trials evolve differently. They gave it as a single therapy. Right now, as the research evolves, Eileen, how are you integrating chemo or platinum with PARP inhibitors in these patients? And in what line?
Yeah, so I think this is a very topical question, and it's when we're seeing a patient with a new diagnosis, we're sort of thinking, what other strategies will we have for going forward, and sort of bringing up the idea of doing germline testing and somatic testing up front, because if we don't look, we won't identify these patients. So that's the first thing. And if based on, for example, family history, ethnicity, personal history of malignancy, your suspicion upfront is high that the individual may indeed have a germline mutation, you probably won't know that by the time you need to start frontline therapy, or biased already in terms of integrating a platinum as part of the plan. And like I think I heard my colleagues say, cisplatin is certainly a good choice in these patients, as of course is modified FOLFIRINOX for those that we know are BRCA positive. And I think the maintenance strategy is very attractive in pancreas cancer and very compelling just in terms of trying to get there before resistance has emerged to the platinum, which is probably a surrogate for resistance to the PARP inhibitor. So the SOLO-1 trial in ovary cancer is exactly the paradigm that I love in this setting for this patient. So it would give probably, you know, 4 to 6 months of FOLFIRINOX, maybe dropping the oxaliplatin, and then for germline positive patients, switch over to PARP inhibitor as maintenance therapy. And that's the question that will be answered from the POLO study that we hope to have data soon in pancreas cancer specifically.
And it's interesting, a lot of general oncologists in breast, in spite of the fact they don't have data, use the ovary strategy because it really kind of makes so much sense. Andrew, what about this, the last question he has about whether or not patients with known BRCA germline mutation should be screened for pancreatic cancer? If so, in which patients?
That's a tough question. It's complicated. If there's a nearby high-risk pancreas cancer program, I think those patients would be best served under their care. But I would say in general, if the family pedigree has patients with pancreas cancer, absolutely you have to screen for pancreas cancer, and almost any BRCA mutation would be very concerning, and you can do that with MRIs or EUSs, whatever you have access to, and we'd probably do it yearly. Sometimes you alternate EUS and MRI, and again, a lot of it depends on the family pedigree.
So yeah, actually in the faculty room prior to this, we were kind of trading stories, or they were trading stories, and I heard a number of situations where like spouses got pancreatic cancer, Philip, or, you know, can you comment a little bit on, I forget which one of you had which case, but there are a whole bunch of cases.
Yeah, I had father and son.
Father and son, right.
BRCA1.
Both BRCA, and they both got it.
Yeah, BRCA1, yeah.
And then, Eileen, I think you had a spouse.
It was four sets of husbands and wives
four
over a number of years.
Four sets of husbands and wives.
Amazing,
had pancreatic
right?
cancer.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Margaret, coincidence or environment?
I think it's just a really unfortunate coincidence, unless you have some high-risk setting. I mean, you could have two Ashkenazi, you know, that had that heritage, and then they both were at risk. But I don't think it's environment.
The last working group case was a 51-year-old patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer and multiple comorbidities who received dose-reduced gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel and had a good response, but discontinued treatment due to peripheral vascular disease. Following disease progression, he was treated with pembrolizumab off-label with an immediate response that is ongoing 1 year later. The question from the working group was how to explain the response in this patient. Another question related to this was whether or not there is any role for checkpoint inhibitors in patients with a microsatellite stable disease.
So this is fascinating, and I would suspect, I don't know that we know the genomic details here, that this patient has germline Lynch. That's the most likely scenario, and we certainly see responses in that setting. There aren't a huge number of reported patients because this is a rare entity, but these agents do work as single agents in this population, and I have a fascinating story of I think we first met him, he was in his 70s, he lived about 12 years, and his initial cancer diagnosis was pancreas cancer, which metastasized, and during the course of a decade plus, he developed stomach cancer, skin cancer, a urothelial malignancy, and prostate cancer, and actually had benefit for a number of years from a checkpoint inhibitor, ultimately succumbed not from his pancreas cancer, his metastatic pancreas cancer, but from his urothelial malignancy. So the data tell us that single agent checkpoints in this disease basically don't work. Very low response rate, it's low single digit. And even combination checkpoints with PD-L1 and CTLA-4 also haven't shown an increment. So one would strongly suspect that there's a genetic explanation underlying this patient.
We asked the audience, have you seen an objective response to a checkpoint inhibitor patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer? And actually, it looks like maybe a quarter of the audience has. I don't know how many of those are MSI patients, and a lot of the people have not administered it. So just out of curiosity, Eileen, a patient comes to you, is clearly MS stable, metastatic disease, says, I'll pay for the checkpoint inhibitor. Would you give it?
You know, we discussed that it's very unlikely in that setting as a single agent. Ideally, we would route the patient into one of the many trials that are evaluating this question. I think interesting themes are combining chemotherapy with immunotherapy and combination, not just dual checkpoint combinations, but other immune therapy checkpoint combinations that look interesting in a subset of patients. So that would be the direction I would encourage.
Another topic discussed at our symposium in terms of new agents was the use of agents targeting the tumor stroma, particularly PEG-PH20, in the Phase 3 HALO 301 study that's evaluating this agent in combination with chemotherapy with nab-paclitaxel and gemcitabine. I asked Dr. Tempero to comment on this research approach.
Well, I mean, the preclinical data was incredibly compelling, and it's very easy, I think, to put your mind around a high HA patient and how this might allow for better penetration of drug. So we're very hopeful that this phase 3 trial is going to be positive, because this is a very poor prognosis group of patients. This isn't your average patient. This is worse than your average patient. So I think that this would be a real step forward if this trial is positive.
Any experience yourself with the drug, Margaret?
Yes, I do. I've done an investigator-initiated trial in the neoadjuvant setting. The drug has an interesting toxicity profile because it causes muscle cramping. And it's very difficult to combine it with maybe a more complex regimen such as FOLFIRINOX. Much easier to combine with something like gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel.
Interesting. Philip, any comments on this strategy and the whole issue of attacking the stroma?
So it sounds simple, but it isn't. And the thing which immediately comes to our brain is the hedgehog story. Because it's too simplistic to think that you just release the stroma and everything is fine and the drug will go into... In fact, some comments have been made that if you have very good drugs like an NTRK inhibitor or something, it will work even if the stroma is as thick as anything. So it's not really as simple as that. Maybe more with the macromolecules, antibodies, but really... But we also think that the stroma has biological value. And that biological value might be enhancing the activity of a drug, but also we have to be careful. Sometimes the stroma itself can be restraining the tumor. So it's not as simple. And there's a lot of publications on this, both sides of the stroma, as a helper if you destroy it, or are you doing the patient a disfavor. Now here, we're not seeing clearly evidence that that may happen. So I think we're on the safe track.
Eileen, any comments on this? And also, it's always been interesting, the histology of pancreatic cancer in the primary. Do you see that same stromal infiltration, Eileen, in the Mets?
You do, but it's somewhat less apparent. It's certainly more abundant in the primary tumors, and there's a spectrum as well in terms of the degree of stroma. Yeah, I mean, we're not involved directly in the phase 3, but we do have a supportive study potentially to that, which is looking at rivaroxaban as an alternative oral prophylaxis for the amelioration of the thromboembolic events associated with PEG-PH20, along with gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel.
So a couple final questions from the audience. Philip, I mentioned earlier that someone in the audience brought up the patient who has a BRCA germline mutation, is 85 years old, ECOG performance status of 1, presenting with metastatic disease. What would you be thinking?
So this is a situation where 85-year-old, where on the one hand, I'm concerned about combination chemo to be effective. I don't believe in single agent. This is someone I would get the drug for the patient.
PARP inhibitor?
Yes.
No chemo?
I wouldn't give chemo, no.
Margaret?
Yeah, I'm treating an 89-year-old BRCA-positive patient. We gave Gemcitabine for 6 months and took her off therapy, and she's been in an unmaintained remission for over a year. So I don't know that you would need to go straight to a PARP inhibitor.
Interesting. Eileen, should every patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer have BRCA germline testing?
So I think so. We know from multiple data sets now that if we go for testing based on family history, age, or ethnicity, we miss a significant proportion of people. So in the NCCN current guidelines, there's a recommendation for some groups of people with pancreas cancer and a recommendation to consider it for all patients. And I think that leaves it a little bit open. And you can certainly argue that there's some subsets that are very unlikely. But I think we should be agnostic to any clinical discriminator, in my opinion.
So just to close out here, because obviously this comes up in ovarian cancer, every single patient with ovarian cancer now needs BRCA testing. Maybe you could just share, Eileen, with the audience what you told me ahead of time. I was fascinated because one of the practical issues of germline testing is genetic counseling. And I was really fascinated by what you're doing at Memorial. Can you share it with the audience?
Sure. So we have an approach that we've implemented in the clinic following our colleagues in breast and ovary and prostate cancer, where every patient who comes in the door with pancreas cancer is offered germline testing, and the take-up on that has been extremely high. The traditional way of doing this, of course, is to refer the patient to our genetics team, and with their schedules and the complexity of the patient's illness, a lot of times they wouldn't get there during the course of their disease. So in practice now, how this is approached is we review ourselves directly with the patients, the pros and cons of testing, and show patients an educational video. They're consented, so it's part of our institutional germline and somatic profiling. And we've had a very high take-up rate for this, and essentially now germline test all patients with pancreas cancer, and that's yielded a finding of about 18% in terms of pathogenic mutations, not all, of course, which are directly actionable, but a number, of course, are clearly significant for both that individual and their family.
Yeah, but the thing that was fascinating to me is instead of sending them a genetic counselor, they literally hand them an iPad and say, take a look at this video and explain it to them. Makes a lot of sense.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our community-based oncologist and to the faculty for our symposium. And thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio program on the management of pancreatic cancer based on a satellite CME symposium held during the 2019 Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium.